Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for preachers, teachers, and curious readers of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Rosie Candleful, Assistant Professor of Hebrew Bible at Wake Forest University.
And I'm Paul Essa, a PhD student in Old Testament Hebrew Bible at Yale University. Our co-hosts Rachel Wren and Tim McNeish, as you can see, they are off this week. So, Rosie, you are going to be the driver today for Sunday, November 13th, 2024. And it looks like you have got a cut-up job from the RCL today, which is we have passages from 1 Samuel 1, 4 through 20, and then we jump to chapter 2 of 1 Samuel 1 through 10. I'm wondering, Rosie, what have you got for us here today?
Yeah, that's right, Paul. We do have a bit of a cut-up job. We've gotten used to that from the RCL, right? A bit of this and a bit of that. We're at the start of 1 Samuel, but I'm not mad about this cut-up job. And that's because the RCL has managed to do a really nice job of highlighting the story of Hannah, mother to the prophet, priest, judge, and erstwhile kingmaker Samuel. And the prophet Samuel usually gets the limelight in passages from these books named after him for Samuel and 2 Samuel. But here we get to take a close-up on one woman's struggles, and her struggles particularly with infertility and childlessness and jealousy, a familiar theme throughout the Bible and the kind of female characters that we encounter. It's her extraordinary song of victory that celebrates the surprising upside-down nature of God's justice. Here at the beginning of chapter 2, Hannah's song. And in it, she sings about how God favors the poor and the weak and the hungry. And that song becomes the pattern for the song of Mary in Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, and a song that echoes those of other singing biblical women, like Miriam and like Deborah, all of whom celebrate God's justice in their songs of victory.
It sounds like you're hitting at some good stuff here, some good juicy preaching stuff here. But before we get there, can you fill us in? A little bit of a background would be helpful. Like what are some of the historical or literary like circumstances within which we read 1 Samuel?
Yeah, you're right to kind of point us back toward the context here, right? Because this only highlights, I think, the surprise and the delight of finding an extended edition of Hannah's story, right? So it is not often that we hear women's voices or women's struggles kind of lifted up. So here we're kind of really paying attention to the intimate struggles and sufferings of Samuel's mother at the start of this book that's named after him. So essentially, the books of Samuel describe the period of time that transitions the loose confederation of tribes of Jacob, of Israel, that were led in the book of Judges that comes right before, from crisis to crisis by charismatic but deeply flawed military leaders. So folks like Gideon and Jephthah and Samson, those names might ring a bell. These are the kinds of heroes, deeply flawed heroes, that are leading the community. But first, Samuel begins to transition Israel now toward the period of the monarchy that begins with Saul, with King David, and with Solomon. And this becomes a period of relative stability under a single leader and the dynasty then that is established through David. But Hannah's story appears at the beginning of this book and in 1 Samuel. Right there, she is positioned in the in-between. Still a period of deep instability before the monarchy is established. I'm still kind of into the period of judges. Her son Samuel will be the last of the judges. And despite the people being in the promised land, the people are scattered and divided. The image here is that the tribes are fractured by distrust. We'll continue to see that in the stories of the monarchy. The fact that we focus on this woman, the second wife of an Ephraimite man, a northern tribe, a woman who is deeply loved by her spouse, but suffers. And because in this kind of first chapter, we hear the words that the Lord had closed her womb. So the Lord is responsible on some level. And Hannah and the narrator understand that despite all of her experience of love and of acceptance by her husband, she is suffering. And she strikes me as an important character to see, recognizing that God is as both responsible for her suffering, but still is ultimately the one to whom Hannah directs her prayer. So among all of these stories of men, it's one woman who draws our attention. And here in chapter one, we find Hannah weeping. year after year as she goes up faithfully to the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And this site should ring a bell for listeners because it's a significant one.
Yeah, I kind of like, you know, struck into the story that you're telling here. So tell us, what's the significance of Shiloh here for listeners?
Right. So here I want to draw back on Judges, right? So the very last stories that we hear in Judges also pick up on this place called Shiloh. This is the site of horrific violence at the end of Judges, horrific violence specifically against women. So at the end of the book of Judges, which immediately precedes Samuel in the Hebrew Bible, Shiloh is attacked by the men of Benjamin, who kidnap and capture the women of Shiloh, forcing them to become their wives. And this site of violence against women is also, at the beginning of Samuel, a holy place, a shrine. Mm-hmm. A place of pilgrimage, of worship and sacrifice. And here is where the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord rests. It's the symbol of the presence of the Holy One dwelling among the people. But for Hannah, Shiloh is also a place that reminds her every year of what she lacks and who is responsible for that lack. God has closed her womb and what she most desires at this point, which is a child. And this is a society, lest we forget, maybe not so different from our own, where women are established in some special way by having children, right? A woman with many children is considered blessed by the Lord, right? And many arrows in their quiver, right? But a childless woman, on the other hand, is suspect, right? Somebody who it might be seen as having been abandoned by God or having done something in some way to not bring God's blessings on their lives. They are often seen as less than, looked down upon, and judged by their societies, right? So we find Hannah suffering under that burden, right? Weeping, unable to eat, unable to find comfort in the house of the Lord, distressed, depressed, and as we'll see here in the passage, deeply misunderstood by her religious leaders, and particularly by the temple priest Eli. So we see this kind of egregious moment where a professional minister makes assumptions about Hannah that I think it might be valuable here to slow down and highlight for our listeners.
Hey, this is, this is such a, I don't want to hear this. A pastor who got things wrong, who misinterpreted a situation. Is that like, is that possible?
Right. I know you're being sarcastic here, right? We often get things wrong. I know, right?
Yeah.
But pastors are supposed to get some things right. And particularly when we meet with suffering among our congregations, right? So it seems to hurt more that in this passage, it highlights the error of a professional minister. Eli is the high priest, right? Responsible for the spiritual leadership of the people. And that magnifies the situation here because the priest Eli sees this woman, Hannah, and she has come up for worship. She is praying silently, but her lips are moving. And in that, her lips are moving. She's pouring out her heart before God. She is completely taken up in this moment of prayer, of communion with God. And Eli, unable to really comprehend what's actually happening, he speaks with disdain, and thinking she is drunk, he rebukes her in verse 13. So he says, how long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Put away your wine, right? These are harsh words, right? It's a cutting judgment that perfectly encapsulates his lack of understanding, a basic misapprehension of Hannah's circumstances, and a lack of empathy, right, with what was actually. So even if she had been drunk, I mean, I might ask the question of whether this is a response that is appropriate to a minister to give to a congregant, right? So, I mean, I just want to make sure that kind of that listeners, particularly those who are preachers and teachers who have some responsibility, maybe might hear how the narrator is kind of drawing upon the situation to highlight how unjust Eli's accusation is.
It's really interesting the way prayer and postures of prayer, you know, in the biblical in most biblical narratives are sort of like, especially in the New Testament, are spoken off in like sort of drunken terms. Like you, You remember like several passages in the New Testament, especially like I think in Acts when, you know, the apostles were praying in tongues and, you know, they were accused of being drunk, right? Several places in Ephesians when, you know, the people of God were praying, especially praying in different languages, those moments are interpreted as being drunk. I'm not reducing Hannah's situation here at all, but it's just interesting to say, like, to see how certain postures of prayer are spoken of and written about being drunk, right? That being said, it's quite unfortunate how the shame of being an alcoholic is also put on this woman who is already struggling and battling with the shame of childlessness, something that societally she has to sort of, you know, wrestle with and to fight against on a daily basis. And especially, like you rightly said, coming from Eli, I'm sure would have not only like social repercussions, but also sort of religious repercussions that, you know, you so shamed yourself like in this way that you come into the temple of God with your drunkenness.
Yeah, I think you're right, especially as more conversation happens more openly about spiritual hurt, spiritual trauma that our congregants go through. It seems valuable to kind of maybe spend a moment here on what Hannah's choices might have been in terms of her reaction here. I don't know how many preachers and teachers will want to go there with this passage, but I personally was deeply convicted by this scene. We are often people with authority and particular training to hold positions of authority and power over others. And it's hard to overstate the responsibility we have toward those who are suffering in our community.
Yep.
So Eli's castigation, his dismissal of Hannah, is an awful moment. But it illuminates a failure in spiritual leadership at its highest levels, right? And that's not just then, but also now. But to Hannah's credit, right, she doesn't just leave. She immediately speaks up to correct her minister. "No, my lord," she says, "I am a woman deeply troubled, and I have been pouring out my being, my nephesh, before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman." And that line breaks my heart, right? And fills me also, though, with hope, right? So she stands up for herself. It's Hannah's humility and her dignity that touches me there, right? So, "No, my lord," right? I mean, respectfully still, I am, that's not what's happening here. "Don't regard me as a worthless woman. I have worth. And because I've been speaking with God," right? And Eli, to his credit, he's quickly penitent too, right? And he blesses her. He may not understand, but he says, "Go in peace and may the Lord grant your petition," right? So he allows himself to be corrected. He doesn't probe deeply after that, right? He doesn't probe further. I might question that. But Hannah says, "Let your servant find favor in your sight." And she goes away and the passage says she's no longer sad. Her face is lifted up. So she's received something from this flawed minister. And I find that a really kind of redemptive turn in this passage that could have gone in various ways. We know that in our own congregations, maybe even in our own classrooms, they don't end always so well. People 100%. Leave maybe the relationship, right?
The power of dialogue, right? The beauty of conversation. And I hear you, you hear me, and then we reconcile and move on, right? That sounds like you have a lot more to say. What do you make of this exchange?
Yeah, I mean, I want to pause here, right, and think about what the value of seeing this exchange, because it's such a powerful example of grace in a kind of a real situation where there's been a real misunderstanding. And it gives me a possibility of how we can forgive each other and even redeem, like kind of continue a relationship after making a terrible mistake, right? So to me, this is a hopeful exchange and one which pastors and teachers might dwell upon. Eli and Hannah each part with peace, despite what could have led to a permanent break. Hannah doesn't leave, and Eli doesn't dig in to be, you know, his position or his authority. These are two people who could have stood on their pride, and instead they listen to one another. Eli gives peace even after making a terrible error. And perhaps even then, that says something to me. If I can admit when I have been too hasty in judgment, say, of a student as an assistant professor, I could remember Eli's example and receive this kind of grace and forgiveness, a second chance to build a relationship. Now, we don't always get this lucky, but it gives me just a moment there to pause before I decide that a student is one way or another, I might just take a moment to ask or a moment to observe. And if Eli had done that, maybe that, you know, kind of moment of misjudgment, he wouldn't have had to go that far.
And I think the kind of reconciliation that happens here speaks a lot about what happens in the next few verses afterwards. Because I think, if I remember correctly, correct me, Rosie, that Hannah gives this young son after he had the son to Eli to raise, right? And this minister who got the whole situation wrong, how could he be trusted with a whole parenting responsibility? You see what I mean?
Right. I find that amazing too, Paul. I mean, I'm not sure I would have been able to do the same. I don't know what you think about that, but like, Hannah promises her son, this one that she's been waiting to, Samuel, she promises him to God, but that means that she will wean him and leave him with Eli to be raised under his instruction and care to be a Nazarite and a priest. She's going to dedicate her son to God's service, but until then, she keeps him with her and does not go up to Shiloh again. The next time when she appears, it is after Samuel's been weaned. And she brings her young son, probably only about 3 years old, three, 4 years old, maybe, to Eli, the priest. That is a real moment of vulnerability and risk, right? She's going to leave this son to Eli. And when she brings him, she says that she is the woman who has been praying the years ago, and it was her prayer that was answered, right? So that passage ends, surprisingly, with both worshiping together at Shiloh. So, I mean, profound. Profound trust in God's leadership, you know, despite failure. So I don't know.
Well, you know, and after Hannah leaves her son, Samuel at Shiloh with Eli, we find this prayer, this like really beautiful prayer in 1 Samuel 2. So what's going on with the prayer?
Right. So this is the victory song that Hannah sings, and it is a deeply surprising song in and of itself, right? Mm-hmm. It begins with, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in my God. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your victory." And it repeats a line from the Song of the Sea. So the song at Exodus, "There is no one holy like the Lord, no That's one right. besides you, no yep. rock like our God." So kind of a backwards and forwards look. And then it goes on to describe these dramatic reversals. The mighty and the arrogant are brought low. Those who are hungry are fat with spoil. The Lord makes poor, the Lord makes rich, the Lord brings low, and the Lord exalts, right? The only reference to children and motherhood here in this song is a bit oblique, right? There's a line that says the barren has borne seven, as we know throughout the Hebrew Bible, a kind of a perfect number. And she who has many children is forlorn. She becomes weak. She is feeble. She's even sick, right? That is a surprising turn. That's not what we usually find of the woman who has many children. The song then ends with a praise for a monarchy that we know has yet to be established in Israel. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, she sings. God will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed. So kind of a look forward then to what her son will establish in the monarchy. This is a surprising and a subversive song that Hannah sings, and one that liberation theologists, liberation theology writ large, has seen in its fulsome political potential, right? I am remembering the great theologian, pastor, and teacher, Gustavo Gutierrez, who passed on October 22nd. So we're recording this week. It'll be some weeks yet when you listen to this on November 13th. But this is a song that Gutierrez has also seen that that showcases the preferential option for the poor, the weak, and the hungry.
I remember the song, the prayer, "Give us this day our daily bread," right? Which is also a very pivotal passage in among liberation theologians, which is like an advocacy for the poor and to make food available for those who need it. And I think that Hannah's song here sort of resonates some of that language. And I'm glad that you bring this up. So how might you help preachers with your task here for this week? Let's start with some pitfalls.
So one major pitfall is one that we have talked about before, and that is kind of creating the happy ending out of Hannah's successful birth, and quick quotes around successful, right? I want to warn preachers away from smoothing over the radical nature of these texts, right? They give voice to the pain of women, right? And that is kind of an extraordinary thing to really hear Hannah's suffering. And I I'm a little daring to say mm-hmm. that in this fraught political moment in our country, right? Yep. In the wake of national elections by November 13th for president, mm-hmm. where rhetoric concerning women and reproductive rights had been extraordinarily loud, right?
Ooh, so yeah.
I don't know how preachers could ignore that as we read these passages. And I can't help but hear something in these texts that I think pastors could take the opportunity to grapple with. Now, I don't know that it points to any particular political position, but I think it's important to say what the text is doing, right? Between 1 Samuel 1 and 1 Samuel 2, mm-hmm. Hannah connects her struggles to have a child with political power, right? So this kind of reversals are not abstract, right? Yep. She is thinking, as you said, right, of giving bread to those who are hungry, mm-hmm. And that is God's work, right? And that is a political position, not just mm-hmm. a spiritual one. So I want mm-hmm. to kind of point out again, with, you know, in line with Gutierrez and other theologians that think about these texts, these are not just pretty statements. These are radical and subversive ideas of how political power should be used mm-hmm. to serve the poor and the weak, and that this is in line with God's message and God's mm-hmm. ultimate plan for the world mm-hmm. is to do right by these people, to do justice for these people. So she sees God's ability to turn the world upside down in her personal story, in her ability to commune with God and receive an answer in prayer. And this is not to say that these texts advocate again for a particular political position, but I do see Hannah making a connection between justice writ large and her own answered prayer for her child.
I see that too.
The other kind of thing I, you know, maybe want to highlight for pastors is I find a really interesting connection to our gospel reading this week,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is taken from Mark chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. Mm-hmm. So in this passage, the disciples and Jesus are coming out of the Jerusalem temple, and the disciples marvel over how large the stones are, how great the buildings are in Jerusalem. But Jesus responds in this kind of, you know, warning way. Not one of these stones will be left upon each other. Each one will fall. So this kind of apocalyptic sound to Jesus's response over the, you know, kind of disciples marveling. The disciples then want to know when this will happen. And Jesus warns them, beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name claiming I am and lead folks away, right? So wars, earthquakes, and famines will come. But this is just the beginning of the birth pangs. So I would not have paid attention to this final line here had I not been primed by Hannah's story in the first reading of our text this week.
Yeah.
And in some way, that kind of helped me hear what Jesus is saying and wonder about what Jesus means with this very poignant language. And when he says this is just the beginning of the birth pangs, what does this mean when we put it into conversation with Hannah and maybe even further with our own stories, you know, our own common stories of birth pangs?
Yep. I'm also curious to hear what the writers of the RCL also thought about when they put these two passages together, because, you know, 100% I wouldn't have thought about the birth pangs here in the Mark passage if I had not read the Hannah thing, right? I wonder where all of this is going, and I wonder what you think about this also, Rosie.
I honestly am not sure exactly how to connect them, but I think you're right in that the RCL kind of creates a connection between these passages that it maybe invites us into kind of a deeper meditation and maybe a seeing of what's going on. Like, as you said, both of us have recently had our first children, right? So our first child, both of us have daughters. And the beginning of birth pangs, especially in a first birth, maybe some of our listeners might recall this time, it doesn't always mean the start of birth, right? So I had all kinds of pains in those final weeks. I was hyperconscious of my body, heavy with child, knowing it could be any day now. I also experienced false pains, right? So pains that were alarming, but didn't actually mean that it was time to go to the hospital, right? And they were just pains, but we would call the doctors in our alarm and make sure that we checked them out. I was an older pregnancy, so, you know, we had a kind of additional levels of observation on it. But I needed those experienced voices, help from caregivers, trained and specifically equipped to help me understand how to respond to these pains, right? So I'm not even sure, but I kind of see also a connection back to Eli, also somebody who's trained and equipped to be able to help the nation kind of work through their pains, right? Jesus also kind of calling to ministers to beware. Mm-hmm. Don't just follow these pains wherever you think they might lead. You don't know that that's coming from me, right? So why is Jesus calling the experience of disasters, of war, of earthquakes, of famine, the beginning of birth pains, right? What could that mean with Hannah as a companion? She who interpreted her own birth of Samuel as a revelation of God's inclination to side with the weak, the vulnerable, the poor, and the hungry. I don't know how to connect these two things. Yeah. But I think there is something mysteriously right about hearing Hannah and Jesus together this week. Mm. Because Jesus compares us all to women heavy with child and offers us the experience of those anxious days before the birth of that child, which are full of risk, right? And so we kind of talked about in our last week's episode, this idea of risk, but also full of hope, full of uncertainty and danger. And there is a valuable preaching angle here. I'm not exactly sure how to shape it, but it asks us all to imagine what is next, not to deny that anxiety and uncertainty, but also to say, what is the life that is to come that we are together to create? Together to lean into the experience of those kind of spiritual leaders that are with us, but also to trust our own bodies and our own experience of pain, right? So so the disciples want to know the day and the hour, but Jesus merely warns them that the crises of our day are just the beginning. And I needed the experience of others to help me discern between what was false labor pain and the real thing.
Yeah.
So I wonder if pastors and congregations might consider these two passages together to see what richness and what wisdom emerges in the midst of our own daily crises that we are living into in our own world and our contemporary situations.
I see that, and I see the way you're offering preachers a lot of good things to think about. So preachers, you do have a lot of good things, but you also have some homework to do. So. Take this as a homework moment and, you know, reflect on, you know, all these really beautiful things and let's see where you can go. But I see a lot of fruitful discussion here, really powerful moments here. Thanks for helping us, Rosie, with this passage loaded with so many layers of different things. Your hard work is very evident here.
Well, you're very welcome. I hope someone can find something on how to put those threads together.
By all means. Well, friends, we hope you found something helpful in our discussion today. I'm sure you did. Remember that you can find an episode on nearly every passage in the lectionary by using our search box on our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. And while you're there, take a look at our merch. We have t-shirts, we have mags, we have, you know, beautiful items that you can send out as gifts. Thanksgiving is coming in the corner. You know, think about us. Or make a donation to help us keep the podcast going. I want to say a big thanks to everybody who has made a donation already. Subscribe, send us a comment, leave us a review. And until next time, my name is Paul Essa.
And I am Rosie Candlepole, and have a great week, preachers.
Yeah.
Yeah.